once more unto the breach, dear friends.
They'll fill the wall up with our English dead. English? British.
It definitely English in the
English,
play,
yes. Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Yes. Yes.
If you do, if you have any English dead, we would like to borrow them to fill up the wall.
Yeah, there's a big.
We don't have any.
There's a big hole in the walls of Harfleur, and we need to fill them up with something.
With English,
and
if with dead Englishmen.
Yes, and that is the newest energy saving building material, I suppose, at least in Shakespeare's time. Or he was writing about it from time much before him. Anyway, Henry V is where we get that quote that we say at the beginning of every episode, because it does feel a bit like we are charging castle walls to be live on the air. We are not in living color. We are in whatever color the ether waves are, which you can put on a filter and see those things.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. But they don't fall in the normal color wheel there. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. We are going to talk about silly things, especially the silly ones. Oh, I mean the serious ones. Yeah. The silly, serious things and the serious, silly things that make up our world. We will be talking about the world of finance and economics. But before we get started on that, we have a series of disclosures to make. If that first rambling couple of sentences wasn't a disclosure enough, we're weird. We're bald. We're bearded. Two bearded men talking about economics and finance for 2 hours. That's a pretty big disclosure right there. Okay, those of you that haven't switched the channel already or switched podcasts, we are the Personal Wealth Coach. This is not coincidentally also the name of the firm that's run by these two bald guys. Jeff and Jake, by the way, are father and son. Jeff, Elder Baldy over there, has a white beard, and that's how you can tell him apart in the podcast, in the radio broadcast. Mine is much more salt and peppery. So if you have any trouble distinguishing between the two of us, just fall back on that. We're both wearing some plaid, so that's not going to help you a bit. We're not in living color, so it's just the ether waves. The firm that we have is registered to give investment advice, and it's registered with the SEC to do so, the Securities and Exchange Commission. But we can't do that on the air. Even though we're the ones registered to give advice for the firm, we can't give advice on the air, which is weird. But it's pretty smart, actually, because if we give some advice to one of you and it's good advice to you, I'm pretty certain it would be horrible advice to somebody else also listening. So privacy concerns, we've got to know who you are and understand your situation in order to give fiduciary advice. We can't do that on the air. So instead, what we're going to do is talk about nothing. No. No, we'll do something. We're going to do education. We can't give advice, but hopefully we can help provide you the tools to give yourself advice, or at least know when you need to ask for help. And that's what this program is about. Now, just because the firm's registered with the SEC, that's not meant to imply in any way that the SEC thinks that we, the firm, the two bald guys, are at all significant or important, except in a regulatory matter. They require us to tell you that the firm is registered with the SEC, and then they require us to tell you that the SEC isn't giving anointments of blessing upon us. They neither confirm nor deny, but when they deny, they do it harshly. Most of the time, they don't confirm. Okay, so we don't get paid to do this program. It is also not paid for. We don't pay to do it. They don't pay us to do it. So why have we been doing this for 26 years now? Yeah. Don't ask that too many times. We might stop. It's a good question. We do get some clientele from this over the years. We've gotten quite a number of people to come into our office and talk to us about their investments. But we kind of specialize in high net worth, and most people with a large quantity of money don't make their decisions based on a radio program. So really what we're doing is educating. We believe in it. I would rather everybody know this stuff than not. And now the last, but maybe most important disclosure, most important for the mental health of the two hosts, particularly the elder one. If he doesn't say this at least once a week, his head might explode. I'm sure he mumbles it when he's on vacation just to make sure everybody is well aware of this disclosure. Okay, you have now been set up for your disclosure.
The information we present on this educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
Right. And right before he said that, you couldn't pick it up because we don't have sensitive enough microphones. He gave such an enormous eye roll at me for my setup that should have been picked up by the microphone. All right. So what happened in the market this week? Or the economy in general?
Well, the market, the S&P 500 stock index, which is incidentally the one we use, and I've been asked several times, why don't we use the Dow or the NASDAQ or something? The S&P 500 stock index, which is the biggest sampling, it's about 80% of the stocks listed in the United States, rose a whopping 0.32% this week.
Wait, it and went up just, this week? I saw nothing but gloom and doom all day long, every day, across every news publication. Well, purporting to talk about finance.
Midweek, when it sure enough looked like we were going to default, the United States was going to default, it dropped down to about 4,100, but it closed out at about 4,205, which the stock market has been doing this for some time. The news is apocalyptic. The world's going to end. The finances are going to implode. That's the financial news, and then the stock market kind of zigzags around and rises a little bit. And it's been, well, this is the end of the month, effectively. And it's now risen for 2 months.
The volatility index, we don't track it very often, has been quite high lately. But the net result of all of that bounciness in the market is a very, very slow, gradual growth over the past, well, since October.
Yeah, the NASDAQ... For those of you not, I think most of you are familiar with what that is. National, it actually used to stand for National Association of Securities Dealers Active Quotes. But since the National Association of Securities Dealers no longer exists, it's just the NASDAQ now.
Well, they actually, the NASDAQ became NASDAQ before the NASD stopped being the NASD and merged with the stock exchanges to
become
FINRA.
Since the NASD doesn't exist anymore, it's just a word, NASDAQ.
Right.
It rose 2.51%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 1%. So what's the market do this week? Well, that's why we stick with the S&P 500 stock index. It generally is in the middle and tells us what is going on fundamentally. The SPX, which we refer to, is up 9.53% this year, over 17% higher than it was last October. It remains about 12% lower than it was at the beginning of last year, but it has risen 38% over the last 3 years, and that's a compound average annual rate of return of 11.25% a year. Whoa. So is the market up or down? It's up. It's been higher, but it's up, and it's charging along very nicely. One of the interesting things, and we mentioned this in the newsletter, but there's reading the tea leaves is important sometimes, trying to figure out what's going to happen in the future.
You use tea leaves?
A couple of things.
I do owl droppings.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I don't have an owl, so it's hard for me to do that.
Right. We have to read something in our off time. That's what we're saying.
The short interest on the S&P 500. What is short interest? That's when people borrow shares and they pay, in essence, a rent on them to the brokerage firm. If you have, let's say you have 1,000 shares of AT&T and it's sitting at the New York Stock Exchange. And what your broker dealer that you hold it through, that's sold being custodian, will lend shares out.
And that's usually being lent from people that are their customers. So their customers say, I want to get a premium. Somebody's going to pay me some money so that I can lend them my stock, but they have to pay me my stock back at the end of this, at the end of the contract.
The issue is that's a big piece of how broker-dealers make money. Anyway, short interest is when people borrow stock from the broker-dealer and sell it, and then will have to buy it back
to return it
at some point.
Right. So they owe it, and then they sell it. Why would they do that?
Because they think it's going to go down. They think the stock will be lower in the future. And there are, you can actually buy options on the, you can borrow S&P 500 index as if it were a single company. And you can what's called short it, which is to sell it short.
So you sold the borrowed one.
You don't actually own it, but you sold it. And at some point, you're going to have to rebuy it and pay it back. Now, why is this important, other than the fact that people do it? Because all of those shares that have been sold short have to be bought back at some point. Otherwise, the person who borrowed the shares will continually pay interest and fees to the broker-dealer and eventually will lose any potential for profit. And when we have a very, very high short interest, and I was looking, trying to find a higher point, and I couldn't find it, but I only looked in this century. That means there's a lot of stock that's sitting out there that is going to have to be bought by the people who borrowed it so they can return it. This is what typically gives the kick in the pants to a bull market. And there's a second element.
Wait, I'm going to give a parallel here because it's recent enough that people still remember this. The meme stocks, Bed Bath & Beyond, but much more specifically, GameStop. GameStop had no profits. It was losing money. It owed a bunch of debt. Its net worth, in essence, was negative. It was making negative earnings, which means it was losing money, and it was just had enough cash to keep barely limping along. And a bunch of hedge funds, looking at this failing company, said, I'm going to borrow their stock, and I'm going to sell it. That's called naked short. When you don't own the stock that you just sold, but you're going to have to return the stock to the original owner that you borrowed from. So they have to buy at some point. Well, the Reddit folks, the apes on Reddit all got together and said, buy GameStop. They've already sold it, which means they have to buy it back, which means that's going to push the price up. There's nothing good about the company itself, but because people are betting against it, you can make them eat their hats, basically, by making the price go up while they're holding money that they need to buy the stock back with.
Of course, there was an interesting aspect to that that folks on Reddit figured out. There was more shares of GameStop sold short than there were shares of GameStop.
Right, because some people borrowed the stock and then lent it out after they borrowed it.
Again.
For a higher price.
So the issue is when you have a lot of short interest in the market, it means that there is a prevailing sense that the market's going to go down. However, all those people who sold those shares short have to come in and buy them back. Now, so that is going to mean there'll be a lot of buying that goes on in the market in some point in the future. The second element is it's possible to track what happens to money in general, not with any specific person, when they sell stock or equity mutual funds. And what we're seeing is that money is going into temporary parking positions rather than being spent or going into long-term CDs or something like that.
Well, as long as these short-term interest rates are highest, mm-hmm. then why would you put them anywhere but this short-term interest rate position?
Let's look at the last 3 years of the S&P 500 averaging 11.25% a year. So if you could back up 3 years and you had, even if you had 5% money market funds then, as we do today, and you have a choice between getting 5% for the next 90 days and then you don't know what you get after that, or you had the opportunity to buy into the market and get 11.25 because you could perfectly see the future, which you can't.
You can't. Wouldn't it be nice though?
But over the long term, the average return on the S&P 500, it all depends on when you start measuring it from, but the low end of the averages is around 7.5%. So at some point, people who park money temporarily that they've sold out of stock positions, out of equity positions and mutual funds and actual shares, they either move the money on to do something else, lock it up someplace, or they leave it parked temporarily. And what we're seeing is there's a tremendous, I think something approaching as a percentage of the value of the New York Stock Exchange, something approaching a record percentage quantity of temporary cash sitting out there.
Yeah.
That cash historically goes back into stocks at some point. Now, when it's going to occur?
We're seeing that anecdotally in our business. People are selling things and saying, I'll just leave this in the money market for now. It's paying a lot of money. Now, it's paying roughly what inflation was last year, so it's not like they're gaining a lot, but it feels like they are. This is one of the tools that the Federal Reserve is counting on by raising those interest rates, is that less money is being used to fuel new investments, new company growth, because why would you when you can just sock it away there and get 5%?
The important thing to note here is that when these two elements have coincided historically, it marks that there will be a major rise in the market in the not too distant future. Now, when it's not too distant, it's months, basically.
I was just going to throw in why the short interest in the market was so high. It's because people are afraid about the debt ceiling.
And we were running up well before the debt ceiling became an issue. They're afraid the Federal Reserve is going to throw us into a recession.
Right.
And if they do, the consensus of people who have been right in the past is even if we have a recession in the United States, it'll be very, very mild. The stock market is being amazingly resilient despite all these factors working against it. And one of the reasons it's amazingly resilient at this point is, once again, there's a lot of cash available to buy stocks with, and that's what it's targeted on eventually. So every time the market takes a dip, people come in and buy some more.
Now
so that's very right.
Have we wrapped up the market? Because there's there's just a flood of cool things that we could talk about in combination with what we just said. So quick, what happened?
Well, the yield on the benchmark 10-year Treasury note crept upward to 3.8% from last week's 3.7%, and it's not a big deal because this year, actually going back into December, the yield on the 10-year note has been bobbing up and down. The Treasury yield curve is still amazingly inverted. As a matter of fact, the one-month T-bill, in other words, if you bought, and you can't buy them from the government, obviously, right now, because they can't borrow money. But if you bought on the secondary market a one-month Treasury bill that matures in 1 month, you theoretically are going to get a 6% yield annualized for that month. Now, why is that? Well, because the distinct possibility exists that if you hold it for a month and the government then is supposed to send you your $10,000 that for your T-bill that you bought, they might not. But I don't think that's realistic either. I think they will. And we'll talk about that later. What happens if we default and buy best analysis? And one of the things that's pretty clear is that the first priority will be to pay off Treasury securities. And if they have any money left over, then they can start into some other things. But that's the first priority. Oil rose to, West Texas Intermediate rose to $72.80. Again, that's well within the trading range, nothing big.
Okay. We have a whole bunch of good topics. Recessions, actual real recession happening right now. Germany is in a recession. And I would wrench my arm out of socket to pat ourselves on the back for calling the fact that Germany was already in a recession 2 months ago. But it's really not a good idea to pat ourselves about being right about something so bad.
Well, you can use a German word, Schadenfreude.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that going on. It's very sophomoric of us to be having this conversation. But the German economy is in a recession, and you're still running close to double-digit inflation in the UK. And
it's 7% annual inflation in Germany while they're in a recession.
Right. While we are now down, according to the latest estimate that the CPI came out at 4.4%.
Right.
And that's month to month in both the core and the energy and other things removed sectors. And by the way, the majority of the inflation that's occurring right now, because people are like, I'm not seeing massive inflation in the grocery store anymore. The gas prices have leveled out and come down from what they were. So where is the inflation happening? Well, it's still in used cars. I think I told you guys last week that the price for a standard new car has finally gone back above the price for a standard used car. So that was in the last several weeks that occurred. That doesn't mean that we're not still seeing some inflation in used cars. And that's where the majority of the inflation is concentrated, is used car inflation. So if you're not buying a used car right now, you're not experiencing the level of inflation that we're talking about here at 4.4%. That's still not good. It's still high, and we want to bring that down. But it looks like we're getting, in the majority of parts of the market, we're getting that downward, at least, pressure. It's not rising as quickly. A lot of the areas that are being measured have gone negative. So it's called disinflation. And if you hear people talking about deflation and disinflation and want to know what the difference is, there's sort of kind of a consensus on the difference, but it's not universal. So if you're wondering, don't worry, so are all the experts. The general sort of kind of consensus is if you just had a lot of inflation and then the prices retreat a little bit, but they're still above where they were some unknown period of time just a short time ago, like last year or 5 years, or this is what I mean. There's no consensus on what it means. Then that's disinflation. But if you are running along and you haven't had inflation for a while and you start getting what would have been called disinflation, which means all the prices start going down for everything, that's deflation then. So deflation, by the way, is far more dangerous in an economic sense, by far, far, far more dangerous than inflation. The depressive spiral of prices going down, down, down means wages go down, down, down. Unemployment goes way up. Money supply gets frozen. So it's a bad thing. Inflation is better. It's still not good, but it's better than deflation. Okay, so that was a bunch of rabbit trails. I also had one other main thing I wanted to talk about, and then we've got a question from John. I've been asked several times this week, how is it if we have reached the debt ceiling, and we reached the debt ceiling in January, that there are still one-month treasury bills out there to be traded? How can that be? Because a one-month means it's paid off in a month, right? And if they're not borrowing new money, how are there new one-month bills? Well, the answer to that is there's a debt ceiling. As debt comes along and matures and gets paid back by the government, so say one treasury security comes due and $10,000 goes out from the government, they can borrow another $10,000 now because they're still at the ceiling when they do that. If the debt ceiling was at $10,000 and you can only borrow $10,000 and you paid off that last $10,000, you can do it again. So there is a rollover effect that's occurring that's about to stop on June 4th. They won't be able to roll them over anymore.
Well, there's the other side of that. If you bought a 10-year treasury note 9 years and 11 months ago, it is going to mature in 1 month. So it has effectively become a one-month treasury note. So that's where the interest rates are showing up to.
Yeah. So on the open market, when you are looking at a maturing 1 month, it's going to be at the same rate, whether it was issued a month ago or 30 years ago and is maturing on that same day, because that's how interest rates work. If you want to sell that thing on the open market, that's the interest rate that they're going to want to get. And I know that's a little complicated. As soon as you start talking interest rates and what direction prices go when interest rates go up and down, people's eyes cross and they start going, what's going on? This is weird. But the reality is, if you just think of it like what a lot of people are experiencing right now, if you have a significant cash reserve, most of you are aware that if you just left it where it was a year or 2 years ago, you're not going to get paid much. You'll get paid the same thing you were a year or 2 years ago. And people are getting antsy about that. And they're saying, where can I put this money to take advantage of the high interest that we're hearing about? Why is that similar to what we're talking about in the interest rate elsewhere? When you want to leave a bank to go to another bank, you're in essence canceling their debt. You're telling them to pay back their debt to you so that you can put it somewhere else that's paying more. They've got to liquidate things to give you your cash back, and that's going to hurt them. So that bank's value dropped because an interest rate somewhere else went up. Their value to themselves and their value to their customers dropped. So you are making the same decisions that the big bondholders on Wall Street are making. If you can get a better interest rate, you want it. Yeah, I know that's a weird feeling, but you know, most of us are settling still. A lot of people have left their money in the same account, even though it's not paying them anything. But there's a movement, and that causes banks to get more competitive, but it also causes some banks to go under. With the new Federal Reserve policy of giving big loans to banks that have long-term treasuries, I don't see a lack of cash, though. So the banks won't go under from a depositor run, very likely. If banks continue to go under, it's because their investors are upset with their actions and they don't think they're profitable. So, man, I was rambling all over the place. We have a question from Inquisitor John. Did you want to take it or do you want me to take it?
I can take it.
Okay. You John, read it out.
John asked a very good question, as usual. He says, as I understand it, the attached article says investors are buying high-yield company debt from firms that are awash in cash, which helps their balance sheets. This is in lieu of buying treasury debt because of the impending debt crisis default. Don't companies invest their cash in government securities rather than keep it in banks? Seems like investors are buying stealth government debt. Well, when we talk about awash with cash, large companies awash with cash, we're talking about many billions of dollars. No, they don't put it in a bank account where the FDIC insures the first $250,000 of it. They generally, the major corporations that have the billions and billions and billions of dollars of cash effectively run their own money market account.
Yeah. In the article, it mentions that Microsoft has, as of the end of March, had $104 billion in liquid assets.
So what they do is there's something, we talk about money market funds because they invest in what's called the money market, but there's a short-term money market out there. There's an entire set of a huge number of brokers and transaction specialists and everything else that roll over short-term loans to various borrowers. The largest single borrower, of course, is the United States Treasury. And as Jake pointed out, every time something is paid back by the Treasury, they can re-borrow that money without exceeding the debt ceiling. So they're doing it too. But the money market funds effectively run by the corporations. For instance, Microsoft doesn't put its money in a money market fund. They have their own traders who loan that money out to very high credit rated other people, companies, individuals, corporations for very short periods of time. That's the money market. So there may be government debt in there and there may not be government debt in there, but that's where Microsoft and the people at Microsoft who run their short-term cash positions, that's up to them to determine. And generally speaking, corporations tend to be fairly conservative with that money. If they want it to be immediately liquid, they willingly will take a lower interest rate to make sure they get their money back in 30 days or 1 week or 2 weeks or overnight when they loan it out.
Yeah. And the intent of your question, John, is fantastic. You have uncovered one of the secrets that when you uncover it is very obvious, but most people don't see it. And that is all of our money is intertangled, all of it. There's nothing, all money is debt. It is an IOU. On your cash, it says Federal Reserve Note. A note is a kind of loan. It's a non-interest-bearing loan, but it's just a bearable bond where you take it and you pay it. They don't ask for your ID. They don't want to see that you truly own that money. You own the money because you have it. You can pay with it. Okay, so when we're talking about what backs that, part of what backs this is our confidence that the U.S. government is going to do something to protect its value, that the Federal Reserve is going to do something to protect its value. But all of it is underlined by the fact that the government pays its debts. So it doesn't matter if you're making a profit in dollars and you have no loans from the government, you receive no subsidies from the government, you're part of the same system of monetary policy and controls that has its roots in the government. So in the event of a government default, we can look at other countries to see the effect on even high cash bearing positions of the corporations. But there's a twist, because when Mexico devalued or Brazil devalued or Russia devalued or Thailand devalued, and there's a lot of devaluations that occur across the world economically, when they say, hey, this one fill in the blank denomination is now worth, it's now 100. So they've just done like a stock split to 100, but now that devalues it drastically. So what happens to those corporations? Well, if they're holding the debt of their country that just devalued the money, it's really bad. They don't look good. But fortunately or unfortunately, the big corporations in almost any country put a significant amount of their reserves in U.S. treasuries, which haven't defaulted. So even companies that we would consider to be awash in cash in those countries during a default, they don't do well unless they have external resources that aren't affected by the valuelessness that comes when you default. One of the things, I mean, you mentioned this in passing, but a one-month bill right now is paying 6%. Well, why is it paying 6%? Well, because it's less than 1 month from now. It's just a week from now that we're talking about a default occurring, which means the people that want to give those loans to the government are saying, I know you're going to miss a payment if you miss a payment, so you need to pay me more for the risk I'm taking against the concept that you might not pay me back. So to think of a one-month loan from the government being at 6% when it really wasn't that long ago. I'm going to go back in time to a 1 month in June of 2020, paid 0.12%. And now we're at 6%. So the government is being charged because of the actions of Congress, a much larger interest bill than would have been there otherwise. The market's charging them for it, even though they think it's probably going to be okay. The debt ceiling's going to raise. Hopefully, they're still charging them 6% on their short-term money.
And that is a foretaste of what will happen if the debt ceiling is not raised across the board. Further borrowing by the United States, the interest rates will rise hugely. You know, the 30-year treasury is that you can borrow, the United States of America can borrow 30 years can borrow $10,000 for about 4% a year. That would probably go to 7 or 8% if we default, because you've gone from having a triple, Fitch has already stated that with the United States Treasury is under review for a lowering of its credit rating. If it defaults, they will lower the credit rating. And the lower your credit rating goes, the higher the interest you pay on loans. So interestingly and ironically, threatening to not raise the debt ceiling will dramatically, particularly if they don't raise the debt ceiling, will dramatically raise the future deficits.
Yeah, because dramatically, the cost of borrowing, the interest rate cost, will increase substantially. Because before, you get this really good discounted rate to the U.S. government because it's so safe. And academia, they still call it the zero risk position. I don't think they can call it that anymore.
Long-term debt, borrowing that went up until we hit the debt ceiling by the federal government, and the rollover that's going on as they roll over and they pay off a debt and then reborrow that money by putting it back on the market, is running at approximately inflation levels. So the United States government effectively gets to borrow money for 0% interest. If the debt ceiling isn't raised, and on the 5th, when Janet Yellen now says we will officially stop being able to pay, we miss a payment. Well, actually, we don't even have to wait. If the debt ceiling is not raised this week, next week, this coming week, I will tell you that the interest rate that the United States government will have to pay on its debt will go up substantially. If the United States starts missing obligations, it will go up tremendously, and it will hugely increase the deficit in the national debt.
In the middle of this, I've also gotten people saying, how come Janet Yellen doesn't know when we won't be able to pay? She was just saying June 1st. Now she's saying June 5th. What's the difference? Why doesn't she know what's going on? All of this stuff is based on estimates of when you are going to pay your taxes, estimates on when tariffs are going to be charged, and who's going to pay what in taxes. So if somebody's making more money than they did last year, then that's going to come in quarterly, or it may come in monthly, or it may come in weekly. How do you estimate it? And it may be that they estimated too high and they're clawing back money that they paid in taxes last year because they're not doing so well this year. All that stuff is a fluctuation in the day-to-day how much revenue that the government is receiving. To move it back from June 1st to June 4th or 5th means something good. It means that more revenue came in than was expected. It literally means that somebody made more money than they expected to, which is cool. It pushed it back a little farther, but the default is still a really, 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 say that on repeat for the next 30 minutes. Bad thing. It's a bad thing. Like, underline, bold, italics in red. I can't really emphasize this any more than that. It is not good. And we've got to play some commercials. The email address is in here if you want to join the conversation. It's jake@tpwc.com and jeff@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie. And we'll be back on the other side of these vitally important messages with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff
McClure. We are here to give you more economic drivel. If you aren't drooling with boredom yet, just wait. You can sit on the edge of your seat waiting to be bored.
Let's move on from the debt default crisis. It's not happened. It's one of the things we can control, by the way. If we barrage, I just want to say one more thing about that. I read a very good article today where the scholar had researched Supreme Court rulings on this issue of what debts the government pays in what order. And the first priority is to pay for Treasury securities. In other words, if you have a $10,000 bond or note and it comes due, their first priority is to pay that. Second one is to pay interest to bond note holders. There's a second category, which is contractual obligations. And the lowest priority, according to the compilation of Supreme Court rulings, is general obligations. In other words, something that they promised but didn't guarantee. And Social Security is at the top of that list, by the way. Social Security payments are not a contractual obligation of the United States government. That's why Congress can move the inflation adjustment. They can move the amount they pay you. They can move it around all they want to because there's no contract that says Social Security will pay you. That is at the tail end of priorities. So one of the things to be aware of is if the debt ceiling is not raised in the first by the, and it, and when I say raised, it has to pass the House, has to pass the Senate. Senate will make some changes to it. They have to reconcile it. And then it has to go to the president, which is going to take probably several days. If you're drawing Social Security, and you get your check early in the month, you may not get a check.
There's another piece to this. And this is one of the weirdnesses of life. The software of the software involved in the calculation of who gets paid first. The government may not have the ability to prioritize its payments. And I know that's a weird concept, but it's always had enough money. And if you think how the government works, there's a general fund and it shifts money from the general fund to the different departments based on when draws are submitted and received. And they're submitted and received by lots and lots and lots and lots of different departments, all going to the general fund. They all have the same level of authority when it comes to drawing funds from that communal pool in the software. Of course, because they're head of a department and they're taking what was already approved by Congress. But if the money's not there, there's the software may not exist to give partial payments. It may not exist to prioritize debt like Treasury securities over Social Security. It's a big question because nobody gets to audit the U.S. government's software. they keep that kind of behind closed doors, and for good reason. So we don't know what's going to happen. It's kind of incalculable, more than nobody knows. It's never happened before. It's fascinating. I hope it doesn't happen. But as you said, let's move on to a different subject because we could really literally talk only about the debt ceiling and not cover all of the complexities.
Let's talk about some
of the
things that
dangers.
Have happened.
Yeah.
The consumer raised their spending levels significantly in April. They still have plenty of cash. New orders for manufactured durable goods in April, which is now up for two consecutive months, increased $3.1 billion or 1.1%. The previous month in March, it increased 3.3%. Why is that important? Manufactured durable goods are what companies invest in when they anticipate doing more business in the immediate future. And the orders are rising. We see so many positives in the economy right now. Looking through the economic news, were it not for the debt train wreck potential, the default potential of the United States government, it would have just been strictly positive stuff all week. And it's amazing. The unemployment levels are not rising. Labor Department went back in and revised their initial estimates, and it turned out that the jump to 242,000 layoffs last month really wasn't 242 layoffs. And that's why the four-week moving average is important on that. It's of 230,000, which indicates that we have positive job creation in the United States, significant positive job creation, which you don't get as you head into a recession. Employers look out there and they sense that business is slowing down and they don't hire a bunch of new people. First, way before they start laying off people, they stop hiring people. And it's just not happening. The possibility exists of a technical recession occurring in the third quarter or fourth quarter. But frankly, I just don't see any evidence that it's happening anywhere. I do see the growth rate slowing down some back to a sustainable level, which is incidentally what the Fed is shooting for. But there's everything in the economy that we normally look at indicates we are on the cusp of significant growth, not a recession. All the things we've seen in the past, and admittedly, the leading economic indicators that's put together by the Conference Board is a little more sophisticated in this area. But I think because of the very unusual circumstances we have coming out of the pandemic, that the leading economic indicators may not be very accurate. And certainly, I will say, the Treasury yield curve being inverted is occurring because of a very different situation than we've ever seen before. So again, that may or may not be an indicator.
Yeah, I'm on the site for the leading economic indicators from the Conference Board, and they're still way down from where they were, but we're on an uptick in that. So it could be in recovery mode. Year over year change, we're up, you know, several percentage points over where we were a year ago. Well, things weren't bad a year ago. So, you know, last year we saw all these indicators of being much, much, much higher than where we were a year and 2 years before. But if you look 2 years before where we were last year, that was the depths of the shutdown. So, of course, the leading indicators were up. So the leading indicators are down compared to that enormous growth that we were seeing when we were all trapped inside, when we were buying houses because we couldn't stand to stay in the same house anymore, when we were buying cars that you felt like you had to go rob a bank to get. That is massive economic growth that's occurred there. And car prices are still slightly higher than they were last year and the year before at that time. They've just leveled off. So these leading indicators look like they're mildly starting to recover, but many of the indicators are so wrapped up in things that were warped and distorted by the pandemic, like building permits for private housing, average weekly hours in manufacturing. These are things that the pandemic had a lot more to do with those statistics than the health of the company that was employing them, if that makes sense, or the company that was building the houses and getting the permits. It had a lot more to do with everybody had to go home. So those leading indicators are still in what the Conference Board is saying is a recession signal. And they have, for the last 60 years or so, not been wrong in forecasting a recession at that signal. But we're not seeing one. We haven't had a pandemic in the last 60 years except for this one either. So just because we have a lot of information on a subject doesn't mean we have all the information. And what I'm hoping happens here is that we'll have a better understanding of what these indicators actually mean because we've just tested them in a different sort of economy. That's a bit like the doctor saying, you have a very rare and incurable disease, but think of what we'll learn from you. It's kind of dark interest, but we're going to learn a lot from what we've just been through. We'll be better next time, hopefully. I mean, that's what writing things down is for, I think. We're about out of time for this hour. Did you have something you want to say before next hour?
No, we still got a lot more to talk about. We're in a really, from an economics point of view, a very interesting economy where the economy is doing very, very well. Unemployment is at or near a record low. And everybody is anticipating a recession, which generally indicates the recession won't happen. As a contrarian, I'm becoming much more optimistic.
Okay. We're about to be done. So if you would like to talk to us off the air, our email addresses are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or The Personal Wealth Coach. You can leave us voicemail locally at
254-947-1111.
Or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. If you'd like to listen to our podcast, they're anywhere you could find podcasts. On our webpage, you will find our newsletter and the ability to sign up for it. I think it's pretty amazing. Good newsletter. We'll be back next hour, and we've got a lot more stuff to talk about. Thank you for tuning in to The Personal Wealth Coach. We appreciate you guys.